Hello and welcome to Sports Report Podcast, episode 37. I'm Billy, and today we're back with quite a lot of stuff to talk about. We got the NHL playoffs going on. It's been pretty good over there. Haven't talked about hockey like all year. Playoffs come around, we start to talk about some of that, so we're going to talk a little bit about that towards the end. The MLB going strong right now. Some interesting performances and a little bit of debate. Also, we have NFL as usual, trade rumors and all that stuff, along with the NBA playoffs as well. So let's just get straight into the NFL. And as we all know, the biggest thing happening in the NFL right now is the Julio Jones trade rumors, basically confirmed, because Shannon Sharp recorded Julio Jones without him knowing. And Julio said basically that, yeah, he wants to get traded and he wants to play for a contender. And there's been tons of rumors about where Julio wants to go. And the list of teams really is pretty much the Ravens, the Patriots, the Rams, the Chargers, and some other teams also thrown in there. Really, there's been rumors for pretty much every team, because any team wants Julio Jones at this point, because he's the best wide receiver in pro football. He had injury problems last year, yes, but the stats speak for themselves. Julio Jones is the best wide receiver in the past decade consistently, and he's just a game changer for any team. And the trade value that has been assigned to Julio Jones makes sense for his age, yes, but for the player that he is, it's a bargain. And I think any team, like a second round pick is basically what he's been assessed at by some major reporters. And there's also been reports saying that the Falcons will only accept the first round pick for him. And yes, that makes sense. And I think that's really where his value should be. But unfortunately for the Falcons, it appears that, you know, once guys get over the 30-year-old mark, they go generally for later round picks. That's just how it works. They don't go for first rounders because you don't have that longevity that you have with younger players. Like Amari Cooper went for a first round pick, even after having a little bit of a slump year. Not really. It's Amari Cooper. He still had a good year, but you know what I mean. He went for a first round pick because he was like 25 still, or something like that at that time. And he was an elite wide receiver. Everybody knew his potential. And that's why Dallas gave up a first round pick for him. Julio, it's different because he's 32. He's coming off an injury, a year where he wasn't really able to get on the field as much as you would have liked him to. So he's going to demand more of a second round pick. Now, with some of these teams that are interested in him, I don't really get why. For example, starting off with the Ravens. The Ravens really shouldn't be spending a lot on the wide receiver position anymore. They addressed their needs in the draft. And I know that people are like, Ravens fans wanted wide receivers. And they were concerned, you need to get Lamar weapons. He didn't have enough. He only had Hollywood Brown as his number one. And that's just simply not enough. And I totally agree. But through the draft, they drafted Rashad Bateman with their first round pick. Great wide receiver out of Minnesota. They also drafted Tylan Wallace, who I value at a second round, who went in the fourth, I believe. To them, a big steal. You have Hollywood Brown still there. James Prochet, if you still want to develop him. I mean, you have wide receivers on this roster, and I'm not even sure Julio will do Lamar good enough, because again, I still don't have that confidence in Lamar's throwing. And Julio could be a great mentor to these wide receivers, yes. But the wide receiver room, as of right now, I think is fine for the Ravens. I think their room is completely fine. I think you could leave it as it is. And I think that's honestly what's best for the Baltimore Ravens and what's best for Rashad Bateman's development and what's best for Tylan Wallace's development. Because if you're going to stick them behind Julio and you're going to have this kind of full wide receiver room, you have young guys there. You want to get them playing time. And I just think that the Ravens would be fine without getting Julio. And even if they did get Julio, I still don't see the Ravens as a Super Bowl contender because I just don't have the confidence in Lamar Jackson. Now, looking at it from an organizational perspective, maybe they do think that Julio would get them over the hump. And if they think they're not at that point right now and they think Julio can get them over the hump and get them to be a Super Bowl contender, pull the trigger, absolutely. But I just think that Julio's not going to get them there, and I think they're not there already. I think the path is to just let the younger guys develop. They're not going to be horrible this year. Certainly not. Their wide receiver core is improved. Their defense is relatively the same. Departures of Matt Judon might hurt a little bit. But I think the Ravens are going to be okay. I just think the path right now is not so much win necessarily, like overpay to win now. It's just let it play its course at this point. You address the wide receiver in the draft. You do not need to overpay for it. Do not risk your future in going for Julio Jones. Don't do it. Because you guys don't have the quarterback to utilize a weapon like that to get you a Super Bowl win. The next one that I don't quite understand is in for Julio Jones is the Los Angeles Rams. Now, if the Rams want to go all in, it makes a little bit of sense, but at the same time, they're in cap hell still, to some extent. They've been having cap problems. Julio carries like a $38 million cap number if he stays with Atlanta. I'm not sure what his cap hit is if he got traded, but still, I mean, having a cap hit that big, or any, like, he has a $15 million salary. Having that big of a cap hit going into a team that's struggling with cap problems, you're just going to turn into the Falcons, but better overall team. But you do not want to have those problems and have that. I mean, they've already given up a ton of draft picks in the Stafford trade. So how are you even going to like manage to get Julio? You're basically destroying your whole entire future to go in and get Julio. When I think, like I said, when they got Stafford, I like the Rams as my favorite for the Super Bowl this year so far. I think Matthew Stafford with the Rams, with a core of Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods, can get them. Tyler Higbee also a good weapon there. Cam Akers in the backfield. I think that offense is really good, and it's good enough to get the Rams to a Super Bowl and maybe win one. I view them right now as the best team in the NFC, even with the Bucs pretty much retaining all their stuff. Because McVay is such a good coach. I feel like McVay over Arians is clear, despite Arians winning the Super Bowl. Then again, he gave up pretty much all control to Brady this season and basically just rode him to the Super Bowl. That Super Bowl was not Arians at all. Anybody that says so, I dismiss you. McVay brought Jared Goff to the Super Bowl, made Jared Goff look good. Now you're actually giving him a great quarterback. Goff is good to average. Matthew Stafford is great. He was just in a bad situation in Detroit. Detroit never gave him anything, or never gave him like a complete winning situation. They gave him Calvin Johnson and said, okay, you two just carry the team. And they did to some extent. They just, when you only have two guys, you can only get so far. Now Stafford's with the Rams. You got Robert Woods, Cooper Kupp, Tyler Higbee, Cam Akers. You got a good offensive line, Whitworth at left tackle, good protection. And you got a great defense anchored by Aaron Donald. Do you need Julio Jones? Jalen Ramsey also. Can't forget him. Best cornerback in the game. Do you need Julio Jones? the rich could get richer, but then again, what's going to happen when all these guys retire? Like, because it's an aging team, yes. You've already given up a lot of picks. You guys have like a 3-year window. You guys want to be in a good spot coming out of this hopefully deep 3-year type of run trying to go get a Super Bowl for the Rams. The Rams want to have like a future. And if you're trading for Julio, I can't see them coming out of it with a future at all. You guys already got DeSean Jackson too to sign with you. And you drafted, I believe, Tutu Atwell in the second round. You guys drafted a wide receiver. It's the same as the Ravens. You already invested in the wide receiver position during the draft, and you already, in the first place, probably didn't even have to do that. I was puzzled in the draft why they actually went a wide receiver, especially Tutu Atwell in the second round. More of a fourth round grade on him. But still, I mean, how do you do that at all? I can't understand Julio on the Rams at all. We'll be right back in just a second. We're going to take a quick break. And now back to Julio Jones. So the third team that I think really that is in on Julio, but I think this one makes a little bit more sense, is the New England Patriots. Now, the Patriots make sense because one, Julio already said, or reports came out, that Julio would like to play with Cam Newton. Now, Newton's a big draw for players in the NFL, apparently. I mean, players like to be around him. I understand that. He's fallen off a little bit through OTAs. It's reported that he's looked relatively the same, really hasn't changed much. So it's hard to imagine why players still want to go play with Cam Newton. But Julio Jones does. Now, I still have a relative confidence that Mac Jones might actually beat out Cam for the job in New England. And I think that that's probably, like, that's what's going to happen eventually. Mac Jones is going to start relatively soon. Whether or not it's this year or the year after that, it's going to happen. So if Julio Jones only wants to go to New England because of Cam Newton, it's not going to work out, because either Cam could certainly lose the job straight out of the gate, or he could lose it down the road. I think it's going to be like 4 weeks, then Mac Jones takes the job. But if Julio's not coming there exclusively for Cam Newton, which is a weird thing to do, to like want to go to a team just exclusively for Cam Newton, kind of a weird desire, but Julio, who knows how Julio's thinking. If he goes there because he wants to come to New England, he believes in the system and all that, blah, 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 then it's going to work out. New England's upgraded their wide receivers. They got Nelson Agholor and they got Kendrick Bourne. They also drafted Trey Nixon in the 7th round. Their existing wide receivers, Jacoby Myers, and really, that's it for like guys that are actually going to have an impact. N'Keal Harry at this point has overstayed his welcome in my book and should probably be traded. And if Julio does get traded to New England, we all know N'Keal's not going to be playing. He's just run out of room because Jacoby Myers has secured his spot and Agholor and Bourne are there. So that's 3 guys. Your 4th would be Julio, and those would be your main wide receivers. There's no room for a 5th there. So N'Keal would certainly be gone. But what New England lacks is that number one wide receiver. They have wide receivers. They improved the group by a mile. But what they lack is a number one. And Julio certainly is a number one, with Agholor being a number two, Myers a 2, and then Bourne more of a slot type of guy. So it'd be a perfect offense, having Julio on one side, freeing up room on the other side for Agholor. And then you have Bourne or Myers in the slot, working down there. It would be in a really good wide receiver group and a perfect way to get Mac Jones into the NFL almost immediately. You know, he was scouted as the most pro-ready quarterback in the draft. If you give him this type of offense out the gate, he's certainly going to be the most pro-ready out of all of them by far, because he's going to be throwing to amazing wide receivers, a great tight end group behind one of the best offensive lines in the league, and probably the offensive line with the most depth on it, for sure. So he's going to have a lot of good stuff there. Another team that was also interested in Julio was the Seattle Seahawks. There's reports that the Seahawks are now possibly in. Don't really get it. Don't really get this one. Seattle doesn't make much sense. They already got Tyler Lockett. They already got DK. Cap problems again, and you should probably be focusing on your defense. Julio's not going to make you a Super Bowl contender. It makes you a great offense. You still lack running back despite Chris Carson and a good offensive line. I mean, the things that they already have, so most of these teams that are interested, they just already have good things, like good wide receivers. They don't need it. They need help in other areas. The Seahawks' glaring areas of need is their whole entire defense, their offensive line, and their running backs. You don't need to waste a first-round pick, which they lack generally the past few years, on a wide receiver that, yes, makes your wide receiver core amazing. It already is really good. But you still, all the problems that are preventing you from going far are still there. You're not getting rid of any problems. You're just improving an area that's already pretty perfect. So it doesn't really make sense for the Hawks. What team it does make sense for? San Francisco 49ers. They have a crap ton of draft picks. Their defense is already good. O-line's already good. Quarterback is debatable. Garoppolo I like still, but Trey Lance I also love as a rookie quarterback. So they already have most of their stuff figured out, and their wide receivers are good too. They got Brandon Ayuk, and they got Deebo Samuel if he can stay healthy, and those are really good wide receivers. And behind them, they've had good wide receivers too, and still do. So you put Julio with those two, that is dangerous. And if Trey Lance can live up to the hype, it's just, oh. Talking about how Mac Jones would be pro-ready if you put Julio in that offense. Put Julio with the 49ers offense with Kittle, Ayuk, Deebo Samuel, and now Julio Jones. Mostert in the backfield. He cannot go wrong at all. Trey Sermon also in the backfield too. Almost forgot about him. So like, there's like no way Trey Lance can go wrong if he has that offense. Like, no way. That team is built to win right now. You add Julio Jones, it's not going to cost them a lot because they have the ammo to do it. I say why not for the 49ers? Why not? And then we also have the Titans. Titans, their wide receivers got massacred, besides for A.J. Brown. So it makes a lot of sense for them too. Now, maybe they don't have the ammo that the 49ers have, but still, it's still a possibility. Still a possibility. Tannehill needs someone to throw to aside from A.J. Brown. If he just has A.J. Brown, and I think they drafted Dez Fitzpatrick out of Louisville. Never even had him on my radar. They big overdraft. But if you only have those two guys for Tannehill to throw to, I know it's predominantly a running offense, but when you do that play action that worked so well for them last year with Corey Davis, Adam Humphries, and A.J. Brown, but now you only have A.J. Brown, it's not going to be effective, and that's going to hurt Henry because they're not going to be thinking about the pass. they can just focus exclusively on the run. Henry's stats fall down, Tannehill looks bad, and then Titans go nowhere. And the Titans are a good team. They're a good coach team, and they had a great foundation for those past few years. But now because of cap stuff and Adoree Jackson leaving, Butler leaving, their wide receivers going, they've lost a lot. So you need to fill that void. And A.J. Brown and Julio Jones would be a great wide receiver duo. Great wide receiver duo. It instantly fixes your problems that they have at wide receiver right now. And it's not – this is the one situation where it's like if you left the wide receiver group as it is, it's not good. Everywhere else, you're probably okay. New England would probably be all right. They're not going to be an amazing wide receiver core, but they'd be all right without Julio. You know, they'd function. They'd probably be a playoff team. They'll be okay. The Titans, with just A.J. Brown, I think fall apart completely. If the young guys can't play up to – also lost Jonnu Smith. If the young guys can't play up to the standards of, like immediately, then the Titans go nowhere. So that's where Julio comes in, and I think Julio makes them a good team and still puts them into the Super Bowl conversation, puts them back where they should be. Where they should be. They should be in the Super Bowl conversation, but the team just sort of broke apart towards the end, and that's been the real problem with them. Overall, they just broke apart, and now they really have nowhere to go. And Julio's their escape. And I think if you want to save football in Nashville for this upcoming season and for the possible future, Julio Jones is that guy. And Julio doesn't have to move far. Goes to the AFC South. Should be a winnable division for these guys, the Titans, especially with the Texans falling over on their face like they always do. The Jaguars are a new team, new coach, new quarterback. They're going to be having growing pains. And the Colts have a new quarterback too. They'll probably be having some growing pains despite having a pretty good roster. And if Wentz doesn't work out, then that division's all for the Titans. It's not a hard division. I think if they get Julio, the division's theirs. I think it is theirs, and they have a good shot at doing something. Maybe not the Super Bowl immediately this year, but the Titans have a shot at doing something. The 49ers, on the other hand, win now. That team, if they get Julio, is dangerous, not for the current day and for moving forward. That 49ers team, if Trey Lance pans out, is very dangerous. Very, very, very dangerous. Also, another team maybe to throw in there for Julio is Buffalo. Don't see it happening, though. They already gave up a first for Diggs, and I think they're pretty set. But if Buffalo got if Buffalo got Julio, paired him with Stephon Diggs, team would be insane. The AFC East would be the Bills division for like years on years on years on years. Because Josh Allen's amazing. So, I mean, that would be a nightmare for every other team in the AFC East to try to cover those twos, especially with how good of a season Diggs had last year. Now on to the Aaron Rodgers saga. So Aaron Rodgers, as we know, during the draft, requested a trade from the Packers, pissed off at GM Brian Gutekunst. Very, very pissed off at him for drafting Jordan Love and not drafting wide receiver until this year, where they drafted Amari Rodgers. Still didn't draft one with their first round pick. They opted for Eric Stokes, who I like, but not really appeasing Rodgers. This apparently has been going on for quite a while, the kind of hatred since last season, really. But the trade talk's now coming around right about now. There's reports also that Rodgers is reportedly recruiting a super team of other players. I find this completely hard to believe. Now, I think that Rodgers is right to want out of Green Bay. He wants control of his future. It makes sense. Makes sense for him. And Green Bay doesn't seem to be really doing much to focus on here and now. They're not focused on committing enough to win now, I'd say. They're more looking at the future instead of right now, the Aaron Rodgers era. And I think Rodgers recognizes that and wants out of it. He wants a situation where he can win. And I don't think he's looking at a super team. I think that's a little far-fetched. Now, he might be trying to do something like Brady did. That is kind of the trend now. You see more quarterbacks trying to force their way out ever since Brady did. Now, Brady had the convenience of being a free agent and just leaving. But that last year, he kind of forced his way away from New England, took his focus off of that, and ultimately left, and then kind of formed a super team over with Tampa, bring Gronk back, and then Antonio Brown. Gronk being a key piece in the end, Antonio Brown just being a side piece, not really doing a ton to help that team. They would have won the Super Bowl without Antonio or with him. It really didn't matter in the long run for them. But Aaron Rodgers is trying to do pretty much the same thing. Stafford did it a little bit, but that was mutual. And Watson, obviously, wanting out. So quarterbacks are starting to do power plays. And this is where people get the conception that it's like 2010 NBA offseason type stuff. LeBron forms the big three, and now Brady kind of did that with Tampa Bay, so everybody's starting to follow suit, and people think it's going to be a problem. It certainly could happen like that. It certainly could. It certainly could turn out like that. I don't think it's going to, though. I think it's going to be okay. Rodgers just wants to leave. They're doing the same thing that they did to Favre just now with Rodgers. This is how the Packers seem to operate no matter what. And Rodgers recognizes that and he wants out. Reasonably so. So I think probably the Packers' best move here is to trade him. It's past June 1st. This is the best time for them to trade Rodgers. They've already signed Blake Bortles and some extra quarterbacks to make sure they have enough QBs in the room. So I think they're already starting to move on from Aaron. It's just where Aaron goes. The Broncos are a big name. I think that makes a lot of sense if they want to move on from Drew Locke. You know, they just brought in Bridgewater, so this is kind of they'd have to rearrange a little bit. But Rodgers would make sense over for them. They have a good young core. Noah Fant. Good young offensive line. Garrett Bowles just came into his own. Melvin Gordon's back there in the backfield. They just got Javonte Williams. KJ Hamler. Jerry Jeudy. Like, they have, and still a good defense with Bradley Chubb and Von Miller. So they have a pretty decent team over there in Denver. And that would make a lot of sense for Aaron Rodgers. Also, the Raiders were another team that were rumored. And I think that would make a lot of sense. John Gruden's kind of on the hot seat right now. So getting Aaron Rodgers into that team would probably make a lot of sense to try to save his job. And I think a big splash is kind of what you need for Vegas, because they've just kind of been at the same level for a couple of years, just kind of mediocre. Although I love Derek Carr. I'm a Derek Carr guy. But sometimes you have to realize if you're not putting enough around someone, you need to get someone that's going to make what you already have around them better. And that's Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers would most likely just totally amplify that team. Like, make it completely better, because that's the type of quarterback that he is. Elite quarterbacks make the talent around them better. Derek Carr is a good quarterback, but not, like, a great one, obviously. He's Derek Carr. So I think that would make a lot of sense for both teams. And ultimately, if Rodgers is going to go anywhere, he'll go to those teams. He will. And I think Rodgers will probably be traded because they're preparing for it. It's just a matter of when they do. Not a matter if, it's a matter of when for Aaron Rodgers. So we will see about that one. Let's go on to possible two quarterback system in New England. So there was some talks, Benjamin Albright, he's a big kind of mock draft guy, reporter, who is usually pretty accurate, has insiders. Apparently, a NFL front office person told Albright that New England could be looking at the prospect of a two-quarterback system in New England with Cam Newton running within the 20s. They'll put him in within the 20s in red zone opportunities. And then Mac Jones running pretty much the whole entire middle of the field. So moving up and down the field would be Jones and his big arm. And then once you pretty much get into the red zone, Newton would be working that. And I think this actually could work. You know, people have been talking about two quarterback systems in the NFL for a while. No one's ever had the balls to really try it fully. And if anybody, I think, actually has the balls to do it, it would be Belichick, surprisingly enough. And, Belichick likes Cam Newton. I think he realizes Cam's throwing isn't going to improve. And it's kind of shot. And that getting the ball downfield is going to be a struggle with him. Now, there's been reports in OTAs already that Mac Jones is throwing the ball beautifully. He has a great throw. He's making great reads, great adjustments at the line. And that he's already kind of a step ahead of Cam Newton in those areas. So if you have someone as your backup who's already a better passer, it really makes no sense to start the guy at quarterback that doesn't have as good of an arm, that's not going to give you a better chance to get downfield. Now, if I think Cam in the red zone, you know, big body, good runner, on the goal line, obviously put him in, right? I think it would be kind of cool to see Mac Jones get them down the field and then in the red zone put Cam in, because Cam is a great red zone quarterback. I think this quarterback combination could actually work with a two quarterback system. This might actually be the first two quarterback system we could see, and maybe the first successful one. Because everybody was complaining about Cam's deep ball last year. He doesn't have to throw a deep ball inside the 20. Mac Jones loves to throw good deep balls. So I think if you want to have both of them, and Mac Jones is on a rookie contract, so you can manage the salary there, and Cam is on a cheap deal anyways. $14 million with incentives. You take the incentives out, it's relatively cheap. I think it's like six. If you're only running him inside the 20, he's not going to hit those incentives. So I honestly think that this two quarterback system could work. Belichick is the only one crazy enough to do it. And I think it could work. I really think it could. You know, Sean Payton's already experimented with Taysom Hill and making him kind of a weapon. Cam Newton could kind of roll have a Taysom Hill role if he wanted. With some more throwing in, obviously, more regularly. Probably not putting him as a wide receiver or something, but you know what I mean. Like, running him in certain situations as the quarterback. Mostly read option, run plays type stuff, and then have Mac run the traditional offense in between the 20s. And I honestly think it could work. I'd love to see it. It'd be very entertaining. And I'm usually a guy who doesn't like how much the NFL is turning into college offenses, like how the Ravens offense is basically a simplified college offense. But I think this one could be very interesting for New England. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after that. And we're back with the NBA now. So the NBA playoffs have been going on for quite a little bit now. That play-in round, which was kind of weird, but worked out, I suppose. And now we're having a unorthodox playoffs, I'd say. So far, at least in the West, definitely. Lakers are down 3-2 right now. We'll talk a little bit about that. But first, let's start off with a series that's already gone final yesterday, which is the Nets and Celtics final, which really wasn't about the news about it hasn't been about the basketball on the court. It's been the off-court stuff and just Kyrie Irving being Kyrie Irving. As you might know, if you listen to this podcast, I'm not a fan of Kyrie Irving. Alejandro's not a fan of Kyrie Irving. Aiden's not a fan of Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving isn't someone we have a good opinion of anymore. Now, this guy has been a little off the rails, you know, starting with the flat out stuff, which we thought of was just kind of him just messing around. And then, you know, we talked about it earlier this year when he just disappeared from the Nets for like a week. And then all this stuff. Obviously, the Celtics hate started when he left. And then previous to that, told the Celtics fans that he was coming back. He wanted to have his numbers in the rafter, the whole thing, the commercial, and all this stuff. That's just really built up the hate for Kyrie Irving in Boston. Now, coming into the series, you know, fans finally be back in TD Garden. Kyrie called pretty much that there was underlying racism and all this stuff going against him coming into the Garden, and that everybody hates him pretty much for that reason is what he was saying, which is completely false. It's not racism really at all. It's just the backstabbing that went on. Really the only thing, the only reason why people hate Kyrie in Boston is because he left and said he wasn't going to previous. It was a backstabbing type of thing. If this was like it's very similar to the Durant situation in a way. Now, he didn't leave to a team that beat us in the playoffs. He didn't go and join the Cavaliers again or something like that, right? He didn't go to a team that beat us in the playoffs. Actually, we lost to the Bucks, I believe, that series. So he didn't go and join the Bucks, you know what I mean? Like KD went and joined the Warriors when they lost to them, right? But it's still the same thing. KD, the fans felt that KD totally backstabbed them, right? And the hate pretty much for KD was embraced, accepted, and KD turned into the bad guy. Kyrie Irving, it's somehow different because it's Boston. We hate Kyrie because he backstabbed us. Not because Celtics fans are racist. It's not because of that. It's simply not because of that. Kyrie wants to make you think that way so he can look better in the public, have a better public image, and kind of sweep all this stuff under the rug, although he keeps doing things that like amplify people's attention on the situation, but people can't seem to accept that it's almost the same exact situation with Kevin Durant. That's what I see in this. KD and Kyrie situations are almost virtually the same. It's just it's two different cities. No one said that OKC was racist for booing Durant. No one said that. You know, there's people that come back to the Garden and they have total respect. Total respect. Paul Pierce, he kissed the logo. Of course, Paul Pierce is a much more important figure in Boston sports history than Kyrie Irving ever will be. But Kyrie Irving instead decides to stomp on the logo. And this prompted some responses from Kevin Garnett on Instagram. KG said, "So nobody going to say anything about Kyrie stomping on Lucky, the logo, obviously. We just going to act like that we didn't see that going on. You can't do that. That's not cool on no level. All of us need to be better for real. I'm just saying." So that was KG's words, a true Celtic. I think in almost any sport, right, stomping on a logo, promote, like in football, for example, we got on Juju a ton this year for dancing on logos. We said it was disrespectful. Almost everybody was against Juju, besides for a few little kids, right? And that prompted responses from teams absolutely hating him, right? And having responses on the field to Juju. For example, that Bengals play where he got absolutely destroyed, right? Basketball, we just don't have that, or at least the Celtics don't. Because Kyrie Irving stomped on the logo, right? So you'd expect the Celtics to come out if they had pride in themselves, they had pride in the team or anything like that, or if they just had like some sense of pride, they, like defending themselves, because Kyrie's just tarnishing the team. He's ripping the team apart. It doesn't even matter if Kyrie won the series or not, because we all know the Nets are a better team than the Celtics. That's clear. That's very clear. I was surprised the Celtics even won a game, and they should be proud of themselves for that. But game 7, the Celtics showed zero physical response. Marcus Smart, you think, would be the guy to kind of get up in Kyrie's face, but they're all friends with Kyrie, so they just kind of let it slide. You got to show something. Something, some kind of response against Kyrie for doing something like that, because he shouldn't be doing that. Now, one thing that absolutely shouldn't have happened in response is fans taking it into their own control to try to show some response to Kyrie. This shouldn't have happened. I'm totally against this. On the court, you know, show some a little bit of response. It doesn't have to be like you get in a fire sign, but you know, show something. Fans shouldn't be doing this. A Celtics fan was banned for throwing a water bottle at Kyrie Irving as he was exiting game 6. Should the fan have done this? Absolutely not. Does he deserve a lifetime ban from TD Garden? You know, maybe. I think he should be punished, obviously. That's probably something that should have been done. You shouldn't be doing this to players. This has been going on. It must have something to do with COVID, because like we haven't seen this much. Like it seems like it's every single day of fans doing something. We'll go through the fans' incidents the past few games in the NBA. For some reason, NBA fans, like, since coming out of COVID and you're finally getting full arenas, are just going crazy. I think it will eventually normalize, but it's getting really, really weird. You know what I mean? Just completely, completely weird. Anyways, a fan threw a water bottle at Kyrie. You know, this wasn't going to hurt him at all, but, you know, shouldn't be doing it. The lifetime ban from TD Garden, fine. But he was actually arrested. Okay, he's arrested. Is it going to be like a one-day thing, you know? You run on the court or something, and fan gets released after like 3 hours, right? That type of stuff. No, this guy was charged with a felony, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon for a water bottle. How does this happen? I mean, I understand you don't want fans to do this and you want to like show something, but like show something to have them stop. but a felony for throwing a water bottle that didn't even hit him. And I saw, actually on Twitter, I saw a video of the Arrowhead fan from the 2018 AFC Championship. Yeah, the 2018 AFC Championship against the Chiefs, Patriots Chiefs. A fan throwing a water bottle at David Andrews. Pretty much the same exact situation. I believe that fan might have got a ban, but I don't think he got much. Like, it was pretty much ignored. So, you know, I don't even know how it can be classified as that. I mean, it feels a little extreme, but it is what it is, I guess, there with the Kyrie situation. Westbrook also, Russell Westbrook, he got popcorn spilled on him in Philadelphia. That was one of the other incidents. And then Trae Young got spit on by a Knicks fan. Both of those fans were banned for life, which makes sense. You shouldn't be doing this. At some point, if fans keep doing this, it's going to turn into another Malice at the Palace. It really, really will happen. It will turn into that. I'm not... Did any fans at Malice at the Palace even get charged with the felony? Like, did they? at all? Because Malice at the Palace was like a full-out fight, right? This guy threw a water bottle. What's worse? The spitting on the player, the water bottle, or the popcorn? That's the real question we should be having here. It's what's worse? What's worse out of those three? I think the spitting on the player is probably bad, especially because we're coming out of COVID. And that one was just kind of disgusting. You shouldn't be doing that to any human being at all. That's just disgusting. The popcorn thing. You know, I think Kyrie's is probably the least, but it was the highest punishment. So whatever we will do with that, I guess. Yeah, that happened. Let's go into the Suns versus the Lakers series. Currently, the Suns are up 3-2 after taking a game five win over the Lakers. They won by over 30 points. Were in control of the game the whole entire way. I mean, these guys have been dominating. Devin Booker last night, 33 minutes, 30 points, 13 for 23. 7 rebounds, 5 assists. He's been playing well the whole entire series. Game 1, he had 34. Game 2, 31. Then 19, 17. And then back to 30. Shooting efficiently pretty much the whole entire way. Chris Paul's been a good distributor. The past two games, he's turned it up a little bit. Last night, he only had 9 points, but only played 23 minutes. Again, he's kind of, after that, little injury that he's got, they've been limiting him a little bit. But game 4, 18 points, 3 rebounds, 9 assists, 3 steals, really showed out there. And, you know, I'm really surprised that the Lakers are losing to a Suns team like this. The Suns are very good. Don't get that twisted. The Suns are very good this year. But the Lakers, with Montrezl Harrell, Marc Gasol, Dennis Schroeder, LeBron James, Anthony Davis before he got injured, you know, Caruso, they have a good team. And you'd think that, Andre Drummond, can't forget him. You'd think with that type of team, you'd be able to beat the Suns that have, you know, a pretty solid core with Chris Paul, Booker, DeAndre Ayton, Jay Crowder, guys like that. Darius Saric, who's still on the Suns. You'd think that the Lakers would be able to dismantle that even without AD last night, but they get embarrassed. Embarrassed last night. 30 points. 30 points. I saw some stats a couple days ago that LeBron's like having his lowest scoring series or performing series in like his whole entire career, or at least in the last like 10 years or something like that. Now, he's not performing bad. He's LeBron James. 24 points last night, 25, 21, 23, and 18. All in 30 plus minutes. Last night he left with 5 minutes left, a little bit unprofessional, but LeBron gets to do that because he's LeBron. The Lakers really, after LeBron leaves, are screwed. I've said this before. Now Anthony Davis is out, and they can't win a first-round series, it looks like. I think the Suns actually might win this, especially if Anthony Davis doesn't come back. I think you can book this for the Suns. I think you can book this one for the Suns. Chris Paul, if he keeps coming back to health, gets a little better, this team's going to be even better. And the Suns are actually could be like a serious contender this year for the West, for sure. For sure. We've seen what they can do now with the Lakers. I can't trust the Clippers. I can't trust the Mavs. The Jazz lost to the Grizzlies for one game, so I'm not sure if I can completely trust them. And when your team's beating the Lakers, which I think you could say the Lakers are a little bit, you could probably say they're a little improved based off of the roster moves they made this season and in the offseason. I mean, everybody was freaking out. The rich get richer. They get better. All that stuff, right? The Lakers end up having to play play-in games, the seventh seed, and now they're losing to the Suns. Are the Lakers, is the Lakers championship window done? Is LeBron's championship window done? And I think it actually could be. His window could be gone. It could be closing. It could be over. LeBron's old. He certainly is. And the supporting cast of the Lakers just don't seem to have that grind, that drive anymore. And this could just be like, a year after championship type thing, and then maybe they'll tune it up next year. But, LeBron can only do so much. LeBron can only do so much, and I think the Lakers aren't going to win this series, and it could be a dark road for the Lakers after LeBron is gone and for these last few years of LeBron. I think the West is getting stronger, obviously. The Mavs are one move away from being a big contender. The Suns are now here. The Jazz are now here. The Grizzlies are getting a little bit more mature. Jaw's going to be there. If the Pelicans can somehow improve, they're also getting more mature with Brandon Ingram and Zion. Add a few more weapons in there, that can be a dangerous team. The Nuggets are a great core right now. They're still here. The Trailblazers are still here. And I just don't see any of those teams like backing down or reversing, getting worse. I don't see them getting worse unless the Trailblazers decide to blow it up at any point. That's really the only team. But I don't see those teams getting worse. I see those teams getting better, substantially. Substantially better. So now we have the Lakers. I think this is their last shot. Because if they can't beat these teams at the stages they are at right now, they're not going to beat them next year at the stages they will be at. They won't. And Anthony Davis leading the team alone is just going to be the same result as LeBron leading the team alone. Which we can see right now, last night, losing by 30 points. So this next game, LeBron will respond. Anthony Davis or not, but I don't think it's going to be enough. I think Suns in six at this point. Suns in six or Suns in seven at worst. The Suns will not lose this series. And clip this if I'm wrong and make me look horrible. But the Suns will win this series. Now, LeBron always loses game one on purpose, right? He always seems to lose that game one. And then he goes on a run. That always seems to happen. And there's all those gambling rumors and whatever that you gambles on game one and blah, 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 blah. Anyways, he always seems to lose game one. And then he comes and wins the rest of the games. And then he's, so good. And to be honest, at the start of the series, I was cautious to hitch all this hype onto the Suns because I knew LeBron always comes out on top and he'll win the next four games, blah, blah, blah. You know, they'll go on and probably make another finals. It's different this time. It is different this time. And I think that shows that LeBron is kind of falling off a little bit. Not looking good for him. Not looking good for him at all. So now, today, Brad Stevens, actually, the big news here in the NBA, other than the playoffs, the Celtics got eliminated, as we know, last night. I already talked about this. But the Celtics come out here and say Danny Ainge, he is retiring as president of basketball operations. Brad Stevens is president of basketball operations now. And when this first came out, they didn't say that Brad was going to be not be head coach anymore. So I was like, okay, this is great. There's no middleman anymore. Maybe Brad can get the players he wants to get, coach them up. And, you know, this is perfect. It's a Belichick system. Belichick, as you know, has GM and coaching powers. He can do whatever he wants. He coaches the players he wants to coach. And, you know, he's not unhappy with anything. There's no dysfunction and it works perfectly. That's how you get dynasties, right? Well, apparently, Brad Stevens, too stressed out, he felt burnt out of the coaching job, and now is the president of basketball operations, is not going to be the head coach anymore, and will find a new head coach instead. Now, I'm fine with this. As a Celtics fan, personally, they need to make a change, for sure. Because you cannot run it back for a third straight season. Well, second straight. And expect them to do well. They finished 500. They were below 500 most of the season. The team wasn't good. It was not. And you can't run back the same roster and expect a different result. That's insanity. Ownership recognized the flaw in the team and said, hey, Danny, we want some new thinking and ideas within the GM slot. So we like Brad, but we want some new leadership in the head coaching position. We're going to slide Brad over. You're going to retire, and we'll find a new head coach. And, you know, I think this is good. They need change. I couldn't really identify the change because I think they have a good roster, right? They have good talent. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, Robert Williams when he's healthy. They have good talent. They've identified talent well. Peyton Pritchard is a great role player so far. Romeo Langford's kind of coming into his own this playoff series. He looked like he was coming into his own. Defensively and offensively. So, you know, they have talent. It's just you need the talent to listen to your head coach. And you need your talent to be playing well. If your talent's not playing well, you need to make changes somewhere. Whether that's trading a player, shaking it up, or getting a new head coach, getting new GMs. They decide new president of basketball ops and new coach. And I'm fine with that. I'm completely fine with that. Some of the coaches that I said the Celtics might want to get. First on my list is David Yeager. Now, David Yeager is a coach that kind of fell off the radar because Vlade Divac didn't really like him. And they replaced him with Luke Walton, of all people. One of the dumbest decisions that I think the Kings have ever made, and they've made a lot of dumb decisions. We criticized this back on the podcast. This was like 2 years ago. This is early days of the podcast. We criticized this a lot David Yeager was the coach of the Kings, as I said, and he led the Kings to like the 9th seed in the West, coming off of a horrible season. He improved their record by like 10 wins or something. This is De'Aaron Fox's rookie year, I want to say. Maybe not even. I think it was. Anyways, David Yeager made the Kings like a good team and a fun team to watch at that. Like a good team. He improved them a ton. And then they fired him because Vadi Divac and him had like some problems. And they hired Luke Walton, and then the Kings went back down the drain again. So the obvious answer there was David Yeager was a good coach because they didn't really make much changes besides for the coaching position. And all, it just all went down the tubes, still is down the tubes, and they refused to fire Luke Walton. Anyways, David Yeager's pretty much been off the grid since then. And I think this guy would be a great head coach. You saw what he could do with the Kings. But the only problem I really have is that former players, I think, is what Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and those guys need. They will listen. NBA players today listen to former players. They won't go against them because they respect them. They respect legends, and that's kind of how it is. If it's just some regular coach that hasn't won anything, like Brad Stevens, it's easier for a player to lose trust in them and stop listening. So my next two guys that I thought would be interesting for these guys would be Kevin Garnett, Tim Duncan. Duncan, already assistant on the San Antonio Spurs. I thought that maybe if he wants to come to Boston, I don't see him leaving San Antonio. But, you know, he's already got some experience coaching. And I think bring him to Boston. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown are not going to disrespect Tim Duncan. Tim Duncan is a great basketball mind, and I think he'll do well there. Kevin Garnett doesn't have any coaching experience, but he's a fiery guy, fiery competitor. He wants to win, loves the Celtics, as we read that quote earlier from him about the Kyrie Irving situation. Has respect for Boston, wants to win, fiery, and has a ton of respect already. So I think KG, if he can learn how to coach, actually, would be amazing for the Boston Celtics. Would be awesome. Kevin Garnett on the sideline would be great. I also have Juwan Howard from Michigan, if he decides to leave. Another former player, member of the Fab Five. He did really well in Michigan last year. And I think he could be a good NBA coach. And, again, another respectable player. And some other names that have come up is Chauncey Billups and Sam Cassell. Cassell's been coaching ever since he retired, former Celtic, as well as Chauncey Billups, who was a front office type of guy that was looking for some of those jobs, got interviewed for a lot of those, so he's respected, but also looking for some more coaching jobs. And those two guys could be also really good candidates for the Celtics. Some of the ones that have already been reported is Jason Kidd and former Atlanta Hawks coach Lloyd Pierce. Pierce has a losing record with the Hawks. Nothing really special about him. And then Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd. If you don't know about Jason Kidd, you know, has some of the alcohol problems and stuff and really hasn't been successful, I'd say, as a head coach. So I'd avoid him at all costs. But they're taking looks at those two right now. As of right now, I'd say David Yeager is my dream coach candidate, and you could definitely go and get that guy. Do I think they're going to get him? Probably not. I think they're going to lean more towards former players that already have coaching experiences, like Sam Cassell or a Chauncey Billups, guys like that. I think ultimately they'll probably end up with someone like that. I don't think they're going to go hire a commentator like some betting odds say or anything like that. Don't think they'll go there. Some are also saying women's coaches right now. Becky Hammon and the former coach, former assistant that the Celtics used to have that now coaches at Duke. She is also apparently a possible candidate. Brian Scalabrine also said that she was a possible candidate to look for. So, you know, I think that could possibly work out, but I don't think the NBA is really going to go towards that direction at this time. If anything, Becky Hammond's going to take over for the Spurs since she's the assistant there, well-respected. And I think that's going to be the first woman's coach, but I don't think the Celtics will do it at this time. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with the MLB and some NHL. And now on to the MLB. So let's start off with the Red Sox. The Red Sox had their first full-capacity game. As we know, Boston came back and had all their teams back with full capacity, including the Celtics and the Red Sox on the same, the Bruins and the Red Sox, I should say, on the same day. They had their first full capacity game back in Boston. They were playing against the Marlins. They won that one 3-1. Red Sox currently 32-20. A really big surprise that the Red Sox are so good this year. Not even talking the division because the Rays have been going crazy this season, and Yankees are right there, pretty much a three-way tie, and we thought the Blue Jays were going to be really good. Blue Jays are still pretty decent. I believe Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is the leader in home runs this year so far, but like that, the whole entire AL East, besides for the Orioles, very, very, very good, all looking over like pretty much 10 games over 500. Adam Ottavino, oh my gosh, dude. The clip of Adam Ottavino striking out the last batter in his inning. The movement on his pitch is insane. I mean, Adam Ottavino, as we know, played for the Yankees, was really good, had a down year, now coming to the Red Sox. He's 35, older guy, but has been a great relief pitcher ad for the Red Sox, and just the movement on the pitch. Oh my gosh, you have to look up the clip. It's just very so good. Padres, they're 34-19. They won 11-8 versus the Astros in extra innings through 12. Padres looking very good as expected. They did a lot this offseason, getting Blake Snell and, you know, Tatis, Machado still there. Will Myers, great team. Musgrove looking good. Tatis hit a moonshot three-run home run. No doubter. I mean, this guy is the future of baseball by far. By far the future of baseball. Fernando Tatis, such a good player at such a young age. Probably the best shortstop in baseball at this point. Fernando Tatis is a beast. So now let's get into our little debate we have here with the MLB. The MLB, as you might not know, the MLB has had 6 no-hitters thrown so far this year. Now, that's a lot so far. We're only at the start of June, and they've had 6. The average per year is usually 3. The average is 3 no-hitters. So we're 3 over that, and if a 7-inning no-hitter counted, we would have had 7 with Madison Bumgarner. Joe Musgrove had the first no-hitter this season. And the question really is this a major problem? We were talking a couple years ago about how the home runs were a problem, or when Pete Alonso and all those guys were going off, hitting like 55-plus, and it was just all over the place. But now, because of launch angles and all this stuff, batters are striking out at an alarming rate, and no-hitters are becoming much more common. And I think this is hurting the game. The no-hitters are certainly not doing a good thing for the viewership. I mean, a no-hitter is supposed to be special. And when you already have 6 through like 2.5, 3 months, something like that, we're far away from October, and you already got that many no-hitters. It's kind of unbelievable. As for a 7-inning no-hitter, should that count? I think, yeah. I mean, if it's set up 7 innings, you get a no-hitter, it's a no-hitter. Maybe you can have a different classification for that, but I think it should. But should we be getting this many no-hitters? Absolutely not. The MLB has to do something about this. Stop the hitters from thinking so much about launch angle and just get them to put the ball on the bat like they bat on the ball like they used to. Start trying to hit more for average instead of hit a home run every at bat is what I'd say there. You got to figure that out somehow. Do something to the ball, or like, you got to adjust it, because if the product keeps going forward like this, and you're having, like, we're on pace for, like, 14 no-hitters. If you're having that every year, it's the no-hitter is just not going to be as special anymore. And you want that to be special. No-hitter is supposed to be a thing that's celebrated. You watch one, you get a notification for one in the eighth inning that you're not watching, and then you go to the TV and you watch the whole entire thing. You root for a no-hitter, right? That's what a no-hitter is supposed to be. Now, we're seven already in. It's kind of like nobody really cares anymore because we've already gotten seven in like 2.5 months. No one cares anymore. So that's the problem with that. Now on to the NHL. The NHL has been having a great playoffs thus far. Let's start off with the Bruins and the Islanders. In the first game, the Bruins went off, won 5-2. David Pastrnak had a hat trick. Taylor Hall was playing pretty well, didn't have any goals or anything, but was really just – he's been out there. And, I mean, the first round was great. Taylor Hall has just been all over the place versus the Capitals. Was a big part and has just really improved the second line. David Krejci's playing better as a result. I think everybody's playing better as a result of Taylor Hall. Ultimate, just a great steal for a second round pick. He's been a key part of this Bruins team, and with their impressive first round victory against the Capitals, that, you know, they've cemented themselves as a really good contender here. The first game, Barzal only had one shot. Pelech, who's a defenseman, he scored one, something that the Bruins might want to prevent. Pelech has looked very good for the Islanders on defense, preventing the Bruins from really getting anything done. And, you know, good on the offensive end, too. He's a guy that I think is kind of an X factor, really has been an X factor through these first two games for the Islanders, and is something that can really derail the Bruins that they need to focus on. They need to get Pelech out of there. They really need to, like, find a way to get past that guy because he's the one preventing them really from doing anything here. Charlie McAvoy, he had a scorcher it was a great goal. On to game two, the Bruins lost 4-3 in overtime, which was very unfortunate. The first goal was scored by Charlie Coyle. They looked pretty good. And then in the second period, I mean, the Islanders just threw it on. Jean-Gabriel Pigault, he scored one goal and had one assist. And then in overtime, after Brad Marchand had a great goal, and, you know, there were some questionable calls at the end, Bruins were headed towards what looked like a win, but then they went into overtime. Still looked pretty good. Jeremy Lauzon, though, mishandled a puck, and then Casey Zizekas had a free lane, really, to the net. And ultimately, the Islanders won 4-3 in overtime. Series has been good. I think, you know, we expected the Islanders to respond to the Bruins. They ultimately did. And I still think the Bruins are the better team here. Pelech is definitely a problem. They need to find a way to get past him. But I just think the overall talent on the Bruins roster is better than the Islanders. Barzal showed up a little bit more in game two, but he needs to definitely show up if they want to win this series. I just think that, you know, Taylor Hall, Patrice Bergeron, Pastrnak, McAvoy, Jake DeBrusque, when he's on, is very good. Yeah, I Marchand. I just think the talent overall of the Bruins is much better, including coaching, Bruce Cassidy, much better than the Islanders, and I think the Bruins will be able to ultimately shut down the Islanders. But I do think this could go to seven games. The Islanders team is good. Bigot, great player. Barzal, great player. Pelech, great player. I mean, they have the offense and they have the defense. And they played the Bruins close in the regular season. The Bruins just got to put it into second gear and go. Because they have the talent. It's just whether if they have the heart to do it. I think they do. But they need to get past the Islanders here, for sure. The Montreal Canadiens, the Leafs, another choke job for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They were up 3-1 in the series. Ultimately, the Canadiens tied it 3-3. And then the Canadiens won the series. Carey Price had 41 saves in Game 6. In a 3-2 overtime win, Carey Price has been a very good part of the Canadiens team this series. The Canadiens only had 24 wins this season. Joel Armia, he scored 2 goals in Game 5. Perry Toffoli Kanemi in Game 6 also scored goals. Aside from Game 2, Austin Matthews was pretty much dead on the ice the whole entire time. Game 2, he had 1 goal and 2 assists. Ever since then, Austin Matthews for the Maple Leafs, absolute train wreck. Absolute train wreck for the Maple Leafs. And you think him and Mitch Marner would step up when John Tavares went down, but they did not. And even with John Tavares down, you know, a 24-win team versus a 35-win team. 35-win team should be winning that series even without Tavares. Austin Matthews is one of the best in the NHL. Mitch Marner is a great player as well. You want those guys to step up. They were dead in the water. Dead on the ice. Pretty much for the whole entire series. Did not respond. And Maple Leafs have to do something to figure this out because it was an absolute embarrassment for them. And, you know, you just hope that they can do something as a Maple Leafs fan. But, you know, just nothing seems to be happening there. And for our last thing, the Colorado Avalanche, they absolutely destroyed the Las Vegas Golden Knights in their Game 1 game. 7-1 win for the Avalanche. Nathan MacKinnon, one of the best players in the NHL. He scored 2 goals and 1 assist. Gabriel Landeskog, he had 2 goals. Avalanche, 39 wins in the regular season. They already swept Tarasenko and Krug, led Blues team. MacKinnon just so good, man. I think it was the first goal MacKinnon scored. He put it top left, coming from the right. Put it right over the goalie's shoulder. Just such a great player. Nathan MacKinnon actually, like, you know, he's up there for probably one of the best players in the game right now. And certainly the Avalanche right now look like one of the best teams in the West. And I think if the Avalanche can sweep the Blues, had 27 wins only. You know, still a good team, though. Not far off of a Stanley Cup championship. Tarasenko, great. Torrey Krug, great defenseman. But Nathan MacKinnon, so, so good for this Avalanche team. Avalanche, well-rounded. And I think they're probably the best team in the West. Probably going to take the team to the Stanley Cup Finals. If not, win the whole thing. The Avalanche are really looking good. They also added 8 minutes and 25 seconds of a power play. Somehow that happened, but it did. It did happen. They just destroyed the Golden Knights that bad. Vegas also went to 7 with the Minnesota Wild the series before, which is probably a team that they should have dispatched pretty easily. Now they're going up against Avalanche, much better team. And I think that they're just not going to be able to match up with the Avalanche if that's how Game 1 goes. Even with guys like William Karlsson and Stone and all those guys, Machessault, and a Vezina candidate like Marc-Andre Fleury. Giving up 7 goals, it's pretty rough. So, guys, that's going to be it for Sports Report Podcast, episode 37. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll be back next week, hopefully, probably on Friday, we'll be releasing an episode. Oh, actually, scratch that. Probably a Saturday or a Sunday, actually. Go watch my solo show, The Scouting Board, where we look at all of the prospects that have already been drafted so far. I'll tell you scouting grades on them and how they played, and you can look up your favorite players, see if we did an episode about them, learn a little bit more about them, and see how they'll play in the NFL. We're also, once the NFL season starts, we're going to be looking at the 2022 class, guys like Sam Howell, Spencer Rattler, guys like that, De'Eriq King. So we'll be looking at them eventually. Looking to put some more episodes out of that in the future, in the next 2 weeks. Only 2 out right now, Trey Lance and Davis Mills. But there will be more coming on that front. You guys can follow us on Instagram at Sports Report Podcast. Follow me on Twitter at Sports Rep Billy. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Report Po 1. You can also follow Alejandro at SRP. Alejandro underscore SRP. And you can follow Aiden at Aiden SRP as well. And that will be on Twitter. Guys, thank you guys so much for listening. Also, subscribe to us on YouTube for clips and for a ton of other stuff and highlight videos and new content that we're looking to put over there. Sports Report Podcast is our YouTube. Thank you guys so much for listening to us, and share the podcast. And we will be back, hopefully, on Saturday. See you guys. Have a nice day. See you.